and thanks for tuning in to Beats Research Radio, a podcast and YouTube channel dedicated to bringing our community closer to research in the science and engineering fields. I'm Hallie Arnett, and I'm going to be your host on today's episode. Joining us is Dr. Fergal O'Brien. Dr. O'Brien is the Director of Research and Innovation, Professor of Bioengineering and Regenerative Medicine, and Head of the Tissue Engineering and Research Group in the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. He's also the Deputy Director of the Advanced Materials and Bioengineering Research Center. He's a leading innovator in the development of advanced biomaterials and has translated two technologies for bone and cartilage repair to the clinic. Today, Dr. O'Brien is here to speak to us about his research and the new advances in tissue engineering and regenerative medicine world. Dr. O'Brien, thank you so much for joining us here today on Beats Research Radio.
Thank you, Hallie, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk to you and to your audience today.
Yeah, so can you tell us a little bit about some of the current research efforts that are going on at the Tissue Engineering Research Group?
Yeah, absolutely. So our group focuses on using natural polymer materials for tissue repair. That simply means that we develop biomaterials that are based on the tissues and organs that we find in the body. So whatever application we look at, we look very closely at the composition of that tissue, and we try to sculpt the composition into develop a new biomaterial. So we refer to it as a biomimetic approach. And we're carrying out research in a whole variety of different applications, from orthopedic applications to central nervous system applications to cardiovascular and respiratory applications.
Very interesting. So from reading up a little bit, during your PhD, you were looking a lot at bone mechanobiology. And then during your postdoc work as a Fulbright scholar with MIT and Harvard, you then kind of focused more in on the tissue engineering. So it sounds like you've merged those two with the Tissue Engineering Research Group in Dublin. What makes you the most passionate about both of these, and how have you kind of merged them into your research? Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I suppose my fundamental training, I am an engineer. Yeah. And my PhD focused on the mechanics by which bones break and how cells in the bone respond to their environment. And I was recruited to MIT to work on a project which is about bone tissue engineering based on my expertise in bone. But actually, I ended up spending very little time working on bone. I ended up looking at collagen-based biomaterials and optimizing the primary functional properties of these materials so that they could be applied to a whole series of different indications. So when I returned to Ireland after my Fulbright scholarship, it seemed like the obvious things to merge the two. And the early projects that were funded when I came back was on bone tissue engineering, so developing collagen materials for bone repair. And that sort of began to mushroom then. And we started to use the same concept of collagen-based natural polymer materials for other indications like cartilage, cardiovascular, and so on. But essentially, the same premise was being applied all the time. Natural polymer materials with the composition, the architecture, the stiffness, the mechanical properties, tweaked and tailored to the specific tissue we were looking at.
Right. So since you're merging now this engineering approach with biology and now with chemistry of how those materials how they bind together, how they bond together, what does your lab look like? Is it composed of engineers and biologists? What does this setting look like to us?
Highly, highly interdisciplinary would be the way I describe it first and foremost. So basically all of the above. We have material scientists, and they're generally chemists, physicists, engineers, pharmacists, because we do a lot of work in drug delivery, life scientists, so molecular biologists, biotechnologists, and very, very importantly, and perhaps the group that gives us our biggest strength, clinicians, because we work very closely with the clinicians, the people who are going to be at the coalface, to understand the actual problems that they're trying to solve. Because if you don't engage with the clinicians early, you're going to likely to develop solutions for problems that don't actually exist or that won't work in clinical practice, because maybe the material will be too stiff, maybe the surgical procedure will be too slow. So it's really important for us that we understand the problem the clinician is trying to solve.
Yes, absolutely. And it seems that that process has been extremely successful for your group. You've commercialized the two biomaterials that are being used in patients. Can you give us a little bit of a background about those materials and then maybe explain the process in which that happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mentioned that we focus on biomimetic materials. Well, at a simple level, bone consists of two things: collagen, which gives it its biological functionality and its tensile strength, and hydroxyapatite, yeah, ceramic, that gives us intrinsic stiffness and hardness, and it acts as a reservoir for calcium and phosphates and things. So the bone graft material we developed consists of collagen and hydroxyapatite, but we optimize the pore size, the structure, the cross-linking, the way it grades in the body. We then raised funding to expand the indications of that. So we had to test it in preclinical animal models. And in parallel, because we developed so much knowledge on developing these multi-component biomaterials, we thought, you know, maybe we should look at the next tissue beside the bone, which is cartilage. So maybe about a year after we started the bone product project, we got funding for the cartilage project. And that's a multi-layered material. So because cartilage is a very complex tissue with a very hierarchical structure from the cartilage on the overlying joint, down to the calcified cartilage, down to the bone. And we raised the funding for that. We carried out another study, preclinical study with that. But for both products, our first clinical case was actually in horses, because we worked closely with the veterinary school. And I don't know, anyone who knows Ireland knows that the horse racing industry is a major part of the Irish economy. But the veterinary school who we work with, they were acting as a referral site for horses that presented with complex cases. And I was really pleased that we had the opportunity to do this. Rather than just testing a material in an animal, we were actually treating the animal. And in both of those cases, the bone graft was used in a horse mandibular defect. In the cartilage repair product was used in a horse that presented with bilateral osteochondritis dissecans, so condition of the bone and cartilage. Both horses returned to training, and we had really good outcomes. Now, the other thing that happened with those was it gave confidence to other clinicians, it gave confidence to investors that these technologies were worth investing in and bringing to the market.
Okay, so does that mean this? So this middle ground that you did these testing on with the horses, is that not normally a test case that is done when translating to clinic?
No, quite unusual, actually. So we did do the standard. We would have tested the bone product, for example, was initially tested in rats. Then it was tested in a rabbit model. And the horse model came about because of the fact that we were talking with the vets. And one of the vets said to me, you know, we've had this really interesting case and the outcome for this horse is not going to be good. So could we test your product in this horse's mandible, because it's likely she might have to be euthanized anyway? And I thought, well, look, provided we're indemnified, that from an ethics perspective, everyone is happy with it, if it gives the horse a chance, why not? The owner signed off to say that they were happy with it. We tested the product, it worked really well. So the approach was unusual. It certainly played a part. And I suppose because that product worked well, another vet, and it was a different vet actually, came to us with the other case, because they knew that we were developing the second technology, that the cartilage technology was tested in rabbits. We were testing it in goats, part of the planned preclinical test that we needed to do from the regulatory perspective. And then the horse model came again. And in each case, we published it as a case study. Both of them got quite a bit of attention with the national media and international media. And I think perhaps the main reason that the first horse got the media attention was because she was called Beyonce. And I remember a headline that said, Irish scientists treated and cured Beyonce's sore knee. So people probably had a slightly different interpretation of what we were doing when they saw the headline.
Yes, absolutely. That's really great to see that, you know, something that hadn't been done before really, really progressed results and really progressed that technology forward for the better. How can you give us a timeline of what that looked like going from the lab to the horses and then to patients? What was that timeline look like?
Yeah, great question, because We initially got a 1 year proof of concept grant, which was tested the similar pilot timeline for both products, except this cartilage technology was maybe a year and a half behind the bone product. So a year to show proof of concept. The first animal study, the preclinical study, would have been done in the next 2.5 years. And then the horse study would have been in about year four from the time that we initially conceived of the technology. Now, to move to humans, of course, is a completely different challenge, because that's where the regulatory environment comes into play. So to translate the technologies into the clinic, we had to create a spin-out company. We created the company. That meant that we had to identify a CEO, a chairman of the board. Most importantly, we had to raise investment because we had to make sure that these products were manufactured to a standard that they would satisfy the regulators. That took time. That took effort. And so really, from the time of the initial concept into humans, probably about 10 years.
10 years, right. So was it, do you think that your technology kind of progressed quicker because of the addition of that initial, you had the initial idea of just the bone and then adding the cartilage? Did you think it slowed it down, or did it actually speed it up because of that new composite idea?
That's a really interesting question. The reason why it's such an interesting question, the second product informed why we created a spin-out company. Because our plan was to just bring one product to the market. Mm-hmm. And to do that, quick way to the market would have been to license that technology to another multinational company, perhaps a big company that had all the regulatory expertise, all the knowledge in terms of manufacturing, in terms of getting it out to the key opinion leaders. But because we had two technologies, and essentially a platform technology with similar manufacturing characteristics, that informed our decision to go create a spin-out company. Now, that's much more challenging. I have to say, I've licensed technologies to industry subsequently, which is a much easier route to the market. Creating the spin-out is very, very challenging, but very interesting. And you really need to be passionate and have the right people. I was fortunate that I had a brilliant postdoc, a guy called John Gleason, who I am fortunate to still work with up to this day. He was willing to move into the company, learn much about the commercial arena, the business development needs that were needed to take the technologies all the way through. So it's not sufficient to have a good idea. You need a good idea, sure, but you need to be able to show that that idea, it has got potential for investment, that you're solving the right problem. And like any investor will tell you, you need a product, you need the idea, but you need the really good people. And one key person, as I said, John, key to the transition into the company.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's always, to have passionate people working on a project always drives it forward much quicker. So that's it's definitely exciting. If you could, this might be a bit of a loaded question, but what do you think the main or key aspects of getting a technology to the clinic are? Like, what do you say those would be? Because there's probably many, but if you could narrow it down to a couple, what would be advice from you on that?
Yeah, and I suppose if you were to ask me now, having gone through the process, and ask me 10 years ago when we were looking at the company, where it was going and things, something stays the same, which is you have to have a good idea, you know? There has to be a good concept. It has to present some novelty. And it has to be focused on a real problem, because if the market size isn't big enough, the idea is going to go nowhere, because you're not going to go and get the investors. I mean, we often say in engineering about, you know, creating round pegs for square holes. You have to have the right product for the right market. And it's really important that you know your market. And what can be interesting in the commercialization side is you're telling investors how novel your product is. But when you go to try and get that product through to the clinic, you're telling regulators that it's simple. And it's very hard to get that balance right between making sure it's novel enough that you can raise the investment while making sure it's simple enough to manufacture and that it can get through the regulatory process and be approved at the same time. And that's a tricky trade-off. And one of the things we did, for example, the collagen hydroxyapatite material, the bone graft substitute, we were initially making the ceramic ourselves with what we thought was a really interesting manufacturing process to produce hydroxyapatite nanoparticles. But when we spun out the company, we changed tack and we instead bought the ceramic from another company who were producing medical grade ceramic, because it meant it was easier to produce it and to produce it at a standard that the regulators were happy with. And that's something that would probably inform our thinking a little bit more now. If we were doing the same thing again, we probably would have said, okay, our interest, the novelty is on the material density, the pore size. Let's just get the ceramic from somebody who makes ceramic parts as well too. So like I say, the team then is a third part of that. You have to have the right people, and you have to have motivated people, and you have to be able to convince both investors and key opinion leaders that this concept is good and that the people who are driving it forward know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I also think that the science, as you kind of mentioned a little bit in there, the scientific communication becomes extremely important, because when you're talking to an investor, that simple breakdown of how things are going to go, how the technology works, is extremely important. So do you think there was a that might have been a key as well to being able to communicate that type of science and pushing it forward, that scientific communication was a key leader in that?
Yeah, absolutely huge. Because when you go and pitch to a bunch of investors that to invest a lot of bear money into your technology, you need to be able to keep it pretty simple. You know, they're going to bring in experts to ask technical questions if they think the technical questions need to be asked. But you need to be able to get an elevator pitch. We often talk about elevator pitches, that the message, the problem is clear from the outside. Then they're going to do due diligence and go back into the fundamentals and look at exactly how good is the science behind it. And perhaps something else, and maybe that I think is a good thing. I think we would probably have underestimated how smart some of the investment community are, and thinking the venture capitalist community. And they know that if you're publishing your research, your science in the top journals, they know that that gives a good indication of quality behind it, because it's going out to peer review. And I suppose anytime now we get involved in a commercial project, if we're working with an industry partner, one thing we will always want to retain is the ability to publish our research in top journals. So often we will, you know, we will file the patent application, but we will publish whatever is patented in leading journals as well too. A little bit, it'll be delayed a little bit, but we will certainly be striving for top quality publication, because we want the scientific community to benefit from the knowledge that's carried out in the labs, but it also gives assurance to the investors as well.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I wouldn't have thought about that working backwards from the investment to the paper, but it does make sense. So I guess a final question moving forward, what do you expect to see, or what do you hope to see from the tissue engineering field in the next couple of years?
It's a lot of things are really happening. And I suppose if you look where we are in our own group, we moved from bone and cartilage into areas now where we're developing electroconductive materials, electroactive materials. And the reason we did that was we started a project in peripheral nerve repair. We realized to increase its functionality for spinal cord repair, we needed to look at other components too. So I think this area of electroconductive materials generally is very interesting. The other big area, big growth area, is in gene delivery. And I think one of the things that COVID has probably done has really shown the potential of things like mRNA, messenger RNA-based therapeutics. We've been doing a lot of work in RNA research ourselves over the past few years, especially in gene silencing. But I do think probably what we've seen with the advancement of the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine is there's a lot of confidence out there that this is a real platform way to go. And I think there's going to be a huge step forward for the regenerative medicine community. Other areas that are really topical at the moment is the area of 3D printing, especially in the area of personalized medicine, that perhaps we can start thinking about developing implants to fit a specific patient need rather than a one-size-fits-all approach. And the last thing I've just mentioned briefly is we hear so much about stem cells. And to be honest, we do a lot of stem cell work ourselves. There's been a lot of poor stem cell work done over the years. But I do think some of the knowledge we're beginning to see in the iPSC, inducible pluripotent stem cell field, is really beginning to make an inroads of where we can go on the next generation of regenerative medicine technologies. For complex indications, the triad is still true. You need to be focusing on the cells. You need to be focusing on the tissue. That for us, that's the biomaterial platform. And you need to be focusing on the cell signaling side of that. So we're designing, increasingly designing materials in which the signaling part is embedded to things like gene therapeutics. And while targeting, you don't get regenerative medicine unless you're getting your cells right. Our preference is to target the body's own resident stem cells. And sometimes we will focus on ex vivo culture, but I think as we're now gaining all this knowledge in stem cell biology, I think we're going to see some really interesting breakthroughs over the next few years.
All right. Thank you. Our Beats Research Radio listeners will definitely keep their eyes peeled for those topics. So this concludes our interview today. Thank you so much, Dr. O'Brien, for joining us here on Beats Research Radio and speaking to us about the awesome research going on at the Tissue Engineering Research Group in Dublin.
Ali, thank you very much. It's been great to have an opportunity to talk to you.
Yes, absolutely. Our Beats Research Radio is supported by the University of Ottawa Heart Institute, the Beats Research Lab, and the Department of Biochemistry, Microbiology, and Immunology with the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Ottawa. Thank you all for tuning in, and don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube and podcast channels. You can also follow us on Twitter to stay in the loop for new episode releases.